Hello there. Today is Wednesday, May the 11th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us. Coming up on the program, it's becoming a big trend in the U.S., and Malia Obama is giving it a big boost. Surprising trends on social media today. Congressional Republicans grapple with the prospect of Donald Trump as their presidential nominee. And President Obama will become the first sitting U.S. president to visit Hiroshima.
When I came to myself, everywhere was just dark. Couldn't see anything and quiet.
Also ahead, Keith Urban makes music out of a profound loss. It's all on today's International Edition. There were two more primary contests Tuesday in the race for the White House. Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders had a big night. He captured a win in the state of West Virginia against Hillary Clinton. And despite a very slim chance of catching up to her in delegates, he told a crowd of supporters he plans to fight for every last vote.
We fully acknowledge we are good in arithmetic, that we have an uphill climb ahead of us. But we are used to fighting uphill climbs.
Let's talk more about Tuesday's primaries and what to look for going forward with VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, tell us how it all played out.
Republican Donald Trump easily won the two contests on Tuesday in West Virginia and in Nebraska. The Democrats were only voting in West Virginia, where Bernie Sanders' victory over Hillary Clinton won't win him that much in terms of picking up the delegates he needs to overtake her in a Democratic primary delegate count. I mean, Hillary Clinton is just about 150 or so delegates short of the number she needs to secure the nomination. She only needs 17% of the delegates remaining over the next few weeks and the rest of the primaries. Bernie Sanders has to do well over 60% to really sort of get close enough to catch her in terms of the allocated delegates from the primaries. So even though Sanders has momentum, he's showing he can win in various states, it's the same old mathematical problem for Bernie Sanders, and that is that Clinton has built up a huge lead, especially when you add in what we call the superdelegates, the party officials, elected officials, who have flocked to her in large numbers.
Are party officials worried about Bernie Sanders continuing to stay in the race despite the obvious need to focus on the presumptive Republican nominee?
I think there's concern among Democrats that they would like, those who support Clinton especially, and the party officials, that they would like this wrapped up as soon as possible. The optics of Sanders continuing to beat Clinton, even though he doesn't really have a path to probably win the nomination mathematically, it makes her look a little bit weak. And this is something they don't really want to see at this point when they're gearing up to do battle with the Republican nominee in waiting, Donald Trump. And they also want to be able to take advantage of the fact that the Republican Party looks very much fractured at the moment.
Are folks on the Republican side, particularly in the Senate, coming to grips with the reality that they probably once thought was unimaginable, that Donald Trump is their party's presumptive presidential nominee?
Well, there's a very clear answer to that. Yes and no. And
okay.
What I mean by that is, of course, some are and some are not. I was watching an interview with Lindsey Graham, who was in the presidential race for a while, was a big Trump opponent, and he's basically said there's no way he can support Trump personally. He will campaign for Republicans in the House and Senate this coming election. On the other hand, I watched Bob Corker, a senator from Tennessee today, very influential. He's chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he was saying that the people who have been jumping on Trump and quick to criticize him need to, in his words, chill out, and that Trump, over the next several weeks before the convention, will develop a set of policies and strategies that will give Republicans some hope. Corker said he will support the nominee. He didn't use Trump's name, but he emphasized that he wants to support the nominee. What you're seeing is various Republicans reacting in various ways. The party is not behind Trump yet. Some are moving in that direction, and there's a major kind of coming together meeting on Thursday, perhaps, on Capitol Hill where Donald Trump will meet the House Speaker, Paul Ryan, who's expressed doubt. So slowly but surely, Trump is trying to bring the Republican establishment into the fold, but some are going kicking and screaming. And this is another role for the modern political convention. That's when you do unite the parties. That's when you bring the challengers together who have fought very hard to rally behind the nominee. Will that happen in July in Cleveland? We don't know. Rubio has said he doesn't want to be Donald Trump's running mate. Ted Cruz is still, at this point, not committing to supporting Trump as the nominee. There are clearly some wounds in the party that have not healed, and there's still some question as to whether they will fully heal by the time the convention rolls around. And one last note about that, Donald Trump recently said in an interview, you know, he's not sure it's that important that the party unify behind him. So there's a lot of moving parts at the moment, and it's going to take time to figure out just how much the party is willing to get behind Donald Trump.
And one last thing. Trump says he has narrowed down his potential running mates for vice president to about five or six so-called experienced politicians. Do we have any clues who they might be?
Well, I saw one of them being asked about this today who's been talked about. That's Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. He did not want to get into that. He said it hasn't come up officially, so he didn't want to comment. You've got people like New Jersey Governor Chris Christie there, who's a possibility, according to Trump. Looks like he is looking for a political insider. He feels that's where he needs the help. After all, he has run as a political outsider. One more thing, too, about healing the party. Some recent polls just out on Tuesday by Quinnipiac in some key states like Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Florida show very close race between Trump and Hillary Clinton, Trump even leading in Ohio. That will give cheer to some of those Republicans who are looking for reasons to get behind Donald Trump. If they believe he can win, it's going to make him a lot easier for them to come to his campaign.
All right. Thanks so much, Jim. Donald Trump also scheduled to appear later this week at a fundraiser for Republicans on Long Island in New York. But as you heard, he has some work to do. You can read more about the U.S. presidential election at voanews.com. Now let's check in with our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, for what's trending online. Hi, G.
Hi, Lori. As always, U.S. politics is a trending topic in Twitter sphere. Let's change the gear from the last 2 days and begin with the Democratic Party. Frontrunner Hillary Clinton announced a plan to cap the child care costs, and under her plan, the cost will be limited at 10% of a family's income, with federal funding and tax relief for low- and middle-class families. She posted a video about the plan on Facebook, and within 4 hours, that clip garnered more than 2,500 reactions, both positive and negative. Most of the top comments were critical of the lifetime politician, criticizing her purported money laundering from the Clinton Foundation and paid speeches to Wall Street.
Even though a lot of people think the election is over on the Democratic side, what
they
else
do.
Are people talking about?
Well, Bernie Sanders is still in the news. Hashtag Bernie in Sacramento is a trending hashtag at this hour. He held a rally in California and said the corporate establishment is getting nervous about seeing 15,000 people gathering in Sacramento to support him.
Let's turn to the GOP side. What's the buzz about there?
It's about a reporter who profiled Donald Trump's wife filing a police report. The Washington Post reported Julia Ioffe, who wrote the profile for GQ magazine, is receiving anti-Semitic threats to kidnap or injure her. Melania Trump had called the profile dishonest. Lori, back to you.
Wow, thanks so much, G. Follow her at G. Abby Lee. We also invite you to follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Here are some of the stories we're following on the VOA website. U.S. and Somali forces raid an al-Shabaab base. More and more women are joining terror groups around the world. Turkey's border closure is dividing Syrian refugee families. And record numbers of Americans are ditching their U.S. passports. Carrying a bit of extra weight may not be so bad after all. You can find expanded coverage of these stories and much, much more on voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. VOA's International Edition continues. 7 decades in the making. Later this month, President Barack Obama will become the first sitting U.S. president to visit the Japanese city where the U.S. dropped a devastating atomic bomb at the end of World War II. Survivors there are already reacting to the announcement.
Before I die, I want to see the president, the sitting president face. That is not for asking for apology. No, just as a human being, you are here and that we are standing on the same land, the same level land, and then pray for the dead.
Spokesman Josh Earnest at Tuesday's White House press briefing talked a bit about the president's upcoming trip to Vietnam and then Hiroshima on May 27th.
The president intends to visit to send a much more forward-looking signal about his ambition for realizing the goal of a planet without nuclear weapons. This also is an opportunity for the visit to highlight the remarkable transformation in the relationship between Japan and the United States.
Now let's dig deeper into what this historic visit means. I'm joined by VOA Asia correspondent Brian Padden, who recently visited Hiroshima. Brian, what can we expect?
A Japanese news organization reported earlier in April that this was in the works. The White House had not confirmed it, but not denied it either. And I think it was last week they said if the president goes, he would certainly go but not apologize for dropping the bomb on Hiroshima in 1945.
I understand Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe will be accompanying the president on the visit and said no apology is necessary or expected.
Yes, no one expected him to ask for an apology. You know, for the Japanese leader to ask anyone for an apology during World War II would bring up a lot of sensitive issues in this region. There has been a lot of clamor recently and a lot of criticism of Abe. There's been a lot of clamor for Abe to renew Japanese apologies for its conduct during the war and during its colonialization of much of Asia, where they had a very brutal history out here. And there has been criticism of Abe, who, since he's been in office the last few years, has been trying to move Japan away from its post-World War II pacifist constitution and become a more active player in regional security. That has kind of raised concerns in the region that kind of the militants would again take over in Japan, and you would see a more aggressive military policy out of Japan.
What are the plans for the president when he gets there?
The Secretary of State was recently there, recently visited the memorial, maybe even meet with some of the survivors. I don't know if that will be the case, but we'll view the memorial, view the museum, probably make some statements. We expect that he will use this opportunity to talk about some U.S. policy initiatives, particularly non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, concerns about North Korea's ongoing nuclear program.
This is historic. This is the first time a U.S. sitting president has actually visited Hiroshima. Is the president eager to heal old wounds? What do you think the main purpose of this is?
I think this has been part of the president's strong belief in kind of pushing for kind of the restrictions on the growth of nuclear weapons. So I think this is part of that initiative. I don't know if it's connected. I don't think particularly it is connected to healing old wounds, because I'm not sure how strong those old wounds are. Of course, there are some hardline pacifists who want Obama to apologize for dropping the bomb, but there is a good argument to be made in the heat of war that the use of this weapon in World War II at the very end of the process certainly shortened the life of the war and saved thousands of American lives. So I don't think the president is interested in opening up the debate about that. I think it's going to be more a more global perspective on the dangers of these nuclear weapons, to talk about how these nuclear weapons kill long after the blast is over because of the effects of radiation exposure, things like that. And he may also talk about nuclear power itself and purposes for Japan.
And of course, there is the whole issue of the presidential campaign here in the U.S. and Republican Donald Trump talking a lot about nuclear weapons, using them, not necessarily ruling that out.
Yes, and Donald Trump in Hiroshima is a well-known figure, and his comments there have brought a lot of anxiety and some anger because he has opened up possibility for Japan getting nuclear weapons to defend themselves against North Korea, and that the U.S. would not be the provider of regional security that it has been since World War II. It will not protect its allies with its own nuclear umbrella. He made those kind of implications, suggestions. He is very well known, and his comments are very concerning here in the region and in Hiroshima, where a lot of people and survivors who I talked to thought he did not have an understanding of the terrible power of this weapon that he was talking about.
You mentioned the survivors. Are they looking forward to President Obama visiting?
They are very excited. The survivors themselves are not. The ones that I talked to are not asking for an apology, but they would like him to talk about the future, would like to talk about the dangers of nuclear weapons. They have gone through their own personal journeys of anger and bitterness and reconciliation with the U.S. When you speak to them, they went through a horrific after-the-blast experience and lots of suffering, loss of family and friends, and blaming the U.S. for this, and then depending upon the U.S. and coming to accept a lot of assistance and help from the U.S. afterwards, and kind of coming to this sense of, as I said, reconciliation and working together with those survivors who have become activists in kind of the pacifist movement, have kind of found colleagues and allies in the U.S.
And, of course, you can read much more on this story on our website at voanews.com. A year off between high school and college is becoming a popular choice for U.S. students, and it's also caught the eye of President Barack Obama's daughter, Malia. The White House says the high school senior will enter Harvard in 2017, not later this year, as had been widely expected. Joe O'Shea is the author of Gap Year, How Delaying College Changes People in Ways the World Needs. That's exactly what Malia Obama plans to do, take a gap year. Joe, what exactly is a gap year?
There are many misconceptions about a gap year. Some people think, oh, I'm just going to take some time off after high school, stick around my home community, stay with my parents, maybe I'll do a little part-time work. We don't consider that a gap year. We think gap years are purposeful, educational, and structured experiences that help a student learn about themselves, develop professional clarity, and grow as a citizen before matriculating in college.
What is your reaction to the announcement by President Barack Obama that his daughter Malia will be taking a gap year?
We're so excited across the American Gap Association and the gap year community with this announcement. Having someone of such high stature and recognition choose to do a gap year sends a strong signal throughout the country and throughout the educational system that gap years are an important part of our educational structure and can be incredibly valuable for students to do them.
You talk about how a gap year can really change people in ways the world needs. What do you mean?
When we look at Western life now, there are a number of problems that we're seeing. People increasingly are experiencing mental health challenges, feeling disconnected. Our connection with our communities and our social capital have eroded over the last few decades. And we need people who have the kind of skills and perspectives that can help us solve really important challenges in the world, right? People who can understand what the world is like from another person's perspective and have the empathy to do so, especially those who are different than them. And gap years, by engaging students with really deep and immersive experiences with communities that often are different, culturally different and economically different than them, help them develop their capacity to be empathetic and thoughtful and sensitive global citizens that have the skills that we need more people to have if we're going to solve some major global challenges we're facing.
And are a lot more universities really getting on board with this idea?
Sure. Increasingly, we see universities setting up special deferment policies for students who elect to take a gap year. And what's most encouraging is that universities are increasingly setting up scholarship funds to subsidize the cost of gap years. And we have an important challenge to make sure gap years and gap year education is accessible to students regardless of income or background.
And certainly with Malia Obama doing this, it's bringing more attention to the idea.
This is actually the biggest thing to happen to gap years in the U.S. context. And it's so exciting because we're getting there's so much attention around gap years. In a taxi I took last night, the cab driver asked me what I was doing here, said I was at an American Gap Association conference. And then he said, oh, yeah, I just read an article about Malia Obama taking a gap year. And he had never heard of a gap year before this article. Some kind of social recognition that this is a valuable experience for students. It is a powerful educational experience that will elevate their educational journey and unlock a lifetime of potential for them.
And now all we need is employers to let us have a gap year.
Much of the attention is around gap years is about the pre-university gap year, so delaying your college matriculation after high school. But gap years can be formative for students throughout higher education and afterward. If people in a career want to take a gap year, these kinds of experiences where we're challenged to step outside our comfort zone and to grow in new ways, those are valuable throughout our lives and can help reshape us as better people and better citizens.
And Malia, the elder of Obama's daughters, is a senior at Sidwell Friends, an exclusive private school in Washington, D.C. that actually helped educate another first daughter, Chelsea Clinton, in the 1990s. Malia is set to graduate in June. The president has said he is dreading the day when Malia leaves for college. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA News is there.
VOA.
Around the clock, listen to VOA newscasts on the top of each hour, along with our detailed news shows and analysis.
VOA News. We're online at voanews.com.
At voanews.com.
VOA, your trusted source of news and information.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss politics in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests discussing politics in DRC. That's next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
This is VOA's International Edition. Multi-Grammy Award winner Keith Urban has released his eighth studio album called Ripcord. The current single off the album, Wasted Time, has reached number 16 on the Billboard Country Charts. As International Edition's David Byrd reports, the new album features Urban collaborating with rapper Pitbull and funk guitarist Nile Rodgers.
Listening to Keith Urban's new single, Wasted Time, it isn't obvious that the song came out of a profound loss. Urban was in the midst of putting together songs for his new album, Ripcord, when his father, Robert, died in December. Keith and co-producer Greg Wells were working in Wells' California studio with pop songwriter James J. Hart Abrahart when the song came together. Urban used imagery from his childhood and his high school years to form the lyrics. Urban also got help on Ripcord from rapper Pitbull, who is featured on the cut Son Don't Let Me Down. The country singer and guitarist said the groove for the song was missing something, and Pitbull had just the right ingredient.
His delivery, and it's probably the Cuban thing, puts him in a different rhythmic place than a lot of other people. So I just thought, man, I've always loved that guy. And instantly, at the same time, I thought, he would be killer on that song. And thematically was part of it, too. You know, lyrically, it was the right song for him. I thought, it's got the energy, it's funky, it's lyrically right.
Keith Urban also got some help from funk guitarist and Chic co-founder Nile Rodgers, who has also worked with Daft Punk, Pharrell Williams, Madonna, and David Bowie. Urban, himself an accomplished guitarist, says he had to prove to Nile Rodgers that his six-string banjo, called a ganjo, worked on the album.
And he'd play his thing, and I'd grab my six-string banjo and just started playing along, and it was almost, I mean, it was immediate for me that these three things went together, this super programmed rhythm thing, him playing the Nile Mojo thing he does, and the six-string banjo all working together really, really well, and very organically, too. Nothing felt forced. It all felt fluid.
Urban said he felt free to create working with Pitbull and Nile Rodgers, even though the CD didn't really fit the traditional idea of country music. Keith says that Rodgers and others don't have any limits when it comes to creating.
They just create. And Nile is all about the feel and the vibe and just going. And keep going until you're in the zone. If you're in the zone, then you're in the zone. If you're not in the zone, keep looking for it. Keep playing and searching towards it and playing towards it, you know. So I think all of that stuff, working with a lot of these guys, I found very artistically and creatively liberating.
Keith Urban's Ripcord has already produced two number one singles, John Cougar, John Deere, John 316, and Break on Me. Keith Urban will tour North America in the summer months and then plans to take the Ripcord tour home to Australia in December. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's going to do it for this edition of International Edition. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. You can also find us anytime at voanews.com. We're happy you can join us. And thanks so much to our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Every year, the United States marks May 11th as Vietnam Human Rights Day to highlight our nation's support for promoting and protecting basic freedoms in that Southeast Asian nation. The U.S. and Vietnam recently concluded their 20th annual human rights dialogue in Washington. The meeting covered a wide range of human rights issues this year, including the importance of continued progress on legal reform efforts, rule of law, freedom of expression and assembly, religious freedom, labor rights, disability rights, LGBTI rights, multilateral cooperation, as well as individual cases of concern. U.S. Assistant Secretary for Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor, Tom Malinowski, told the press that over the last year there was a continued overall decline in arrests and convictions for those peacefully expressing their religious and political views in Vietnam. However, Assistant Secretary Malinowski expressed concern about the recent uptick in convictions for peaceful dissent. He said the United States expressed our hope that this would be addressed and that some of the long-standing cases of concern would be resolved. Among the individual cases raised by the United States was Nguyen Van Dai, a prominent human rights lawyer who was arrested in December on charges of spreading anti-state propaganda. In 2007, Dai was sentenced to 4 years on a similar charge. Another high-profile case is that of blogger Nguyen Hu Vinh, who was sentenced to 5 years in prison in March for what authorities called abusing rights to freedom and democracy to infringe upon the interests of the state. During the last week in March, Vietnam convicted a total of 7 activists. According to the latest State Department Human Rights Report at the end of 2015, Vietnam still held around 100 political prisoners. The United States continues to call for the unconditional release of all prisoners of conscience. Assistant Secretary Malinowski noted that the United States also continues to follow Vietnam's progress on legal reform necessary to bring Vietnamese laws in step with Vietnam's own constitution and international commitments. Vietnam's National Assembly is due this year to take up key laws, including the law on association, law on demonstrations, and law on religion, all of which could have a profound impact on human rights. Concern for the basic human rights of the Vietnamese people remains an integral part of the U.S.-Vietnam relationship.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.